Say theater, and many people think Broadway, but in the 1950s, the curtain rose on a new kind of theater in dozens, then hundreds of communities across the country. It was Sirius Theater, a nonprofit theater. It came to be known as the American Regional Theater Movement, and now, on more than 1,000 stages, before more than 30 million people every year, it's the place where American theater meets its audience. Today, we begin a weekly series, American Stages. We'll head backstage to see how regional theaters around the country help shape the cultural landscape. NPR's Bob Mondello has an overview.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a sizable community in the U.S. where something like this is
not taking place.
No.
We're waiting until the costume is done, and then we'll dress the mic for the costume.
Theater, that low-tech, labor-intensive art form that famously requires just three planks and a passion, has become a $1.4 billion enterprise in what were once considered the hinterlands outside Manhattan. Even the most New York-oriented plays tend to begin life in other cities. For instance, Los Angeles and San Francisco both cheered local productions of Angels in America before it ever hit HBO or even Broadway.
Well, oh boy, a gay Republican.
Excuse me?
Nothing.
I am not. Forget it.
Republican? You're not Republican?
The nationwide network of stages that helped playwright Tony Kushner polish this epic social fantasia over time was barely imaginable 6 decades ago. Back then, the phrase American theater meant plays and musicals on Broadway. The rest of the country was dismissed as the road and got what were often second-rate Broadway tours, which frustrated people like Zelda Fitchhandler, the founder of Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., who was then in her early 20s living in Washington and wondering why theater couldn't be an everyday thing.
Like a library, like picking up the garbage, like schools, like churches. Why shouldn't what theater has to give be integrated into community life?
Other people were wondering that too, in Houston, San Francisco, Rochester, and in Dallas, where Margot Jones founded Theater 47 in 1947 and wrote an influential book in which she imagined a day when as many as 40 regional stages would dot the nation. By a decade later, there were 23, most pushing intimacy and the continuity of a season subscription, because they couldn't afford such luxuries as steeply sloped auditoriums and stages tucked behind curtains. Pretty much without exception, they lost money, but they turned that to their advantage by declaring themselves nonprofit by design, like symphonies, says Fitchhandler, which could accept tax-exempt donations because they were educational.
I remember writing that document that said we were a form of education that led people to the edge of their own minds. I remember that phrase. I still like it. The difficulty was that theaters had a profit-making arm. So how do you distinguish between profit-making theaters and non-profit-making theaters?
The answer lay in establishing that theater could be driven by art rather than cash, which meant, says critic Robert Brustein, who founded the Yale Rep in New Haven and the American Repertory Theater in Boston using this model, that the central aim needed to be bigger than just selling lots of tickets.
To do exciting new plays, to do innovative productions of the classics, and to develop, ideally, a company, a group of actors that work together like a ball team works together, knows each other's plays, and therefore can feed each other in a way that strange pickup companies can't.
That, in a nutshell, is the not-for-profit resident theater ideal, and the 1960s were its boom times. Hundreds of stages sprang up, playing Chekhov and Shaw while Broadway played Neil Simon, and tackling social issues while Broadway entertained. And they did this just as the times they were a-changin'. In 1968, these self-styled alternative theaters sent a show to the Great White Way called The Great White Hope, a politically charged boxing melodrama starring a then-unknown 36-year-old named James Earl Jones.
I ain't fighting for no race. I ain't redeeming nobody. My mama told me Mr. Lincoln done that. Ain't that why you shot him?
James Earl Jones won Broadway's Tony Award, as did his co-star Jane Alexander, who would later head the National Endowment for the Arts. The Great White Hope won the Pulitzer Prize, and any doubts about the staying power of the not-for-profit movement evaporated. Resident theaters quickly replaced Broadway as the originator of new American plays, developing a whopping 30 of the next 32 Pulitzer Prize winners for drama, and they even brought distinctive regional sounds to the Broadway musical, teaching it to sing a country tune in Big River.
So look out for me, oh, buddy, buddy.
bluesy jazz in Raisin.
When you've gone and done what I knew you'd do.
Rock in Rent.
How do you write a song when the chords sound wrong?
And even out-singing Broadway about Broadway itself. A chorus line developed in workshops at the not-for-profit New York Shakespeare Festival and first produced there ran longer than any show ever had on Broadway and sent touring companies all over the world. In the process, it helped finance the organization that gave it life for the next two decades. And if musicals could send back lots of dollars to non-commercial resident theaters, just think what a movie could do. Before this week's Oscar winner Morgan Freeman was driving Jessica Tandy's Miss Daisy to $100 million grosses on the silver screen...
Why didn't you turn on Highland Avenue?
Big Wiggly ain't on Highland Avenue.
I know
Avenue,
where it is.
He was driving Dana Ivey's Miss Daisy at a nonprofit stage called Playwrights Horizons.
Big Wiggly ain't on Highland Avenue. Right down there on Euclid. Across the street.
I know where it is, and I want to go.
And hit shows aren't the only thing the regionals have been developing all these years. Again, critic Robert Brustein.
I'm convinced that the best actors in America today have all originated from these resident theater companies. Meryl Streep, Sigourney Weaver, David Hyde Pierce, James Norton.
And
Tony
Denzel
Sheldon,
Washington, Chris Ned Beatty, Walker. Raul Julia, Diane Wiest. Calista Flockhart worked in Midwestern rep companies before she played Ally McBeal. John Malkovich got his start at Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater. And this year's Oscar nominee Annette Bening remembers all too well honing her craft in San Francisco at the American Conservatory Theater, where for 3 years, fresh out of college, she did pretty much everything the company did, good or bad.
Well, let's say they weren't all big hits. Let's put it that way. But the production that we did of Arms and the Man was just one of those truly joyous experiences. But I had a number of great experiences there doing play after play. And I think for me, that was my joy, was doing repertory.
Repertory. Different shows every night in a company where you feel safe enough to take risks. But supporting whole companies got expensive and the regional movement changed, becoming, among other things, less regional, says avant-garde director Ann Bogart, who heads the City Company.
If you grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and you want to work at Actors Theatre of Louisville, you have to move to New York, get yourself an apartment, go to an audition, and get hired in Louisville, Kentucky as a New York actor. There was a time when there were many companies. These companies do not exist anymore, and it is not what it once was.
This feeling that institutional theaters have compromised their original dream is widespread enough to have spawned rebellion in the ranks. A few years back, some smaller troops formed a movement called the Rat Conference to bring theater to audiences that are not served by the resident stages. Again, Anne Bogart.
Arts centers around the country, you find them in every major city. The Wexner in Columbus, the Walker in Minneapolis, Pica in Portland, On the Boards in Seattle, the Hancher in Iowa City. The audiences are more diverse and more excited to go on a journey that they're not familiar with. It's a completely different structure. They're not producing organizations, they're presenting organizations for the most part.
In other words, as the big resident theaters have become the establishment that Broadway used to be, these smaller troupes have found a way to reinvent touring companies and the road. Happily, with more people attending professional live theater each year than attend pro football and pro basketball combined, there is room in the regional theater tent for lots of different approaches. Today, according to Theater Communications Group, there are 1,274 professional not-for-profit theaters in the U.S. Each year, they mount some 13,000 productions for an audience of more than 34 million theatergoers, roughly three times the number who see shows on Broadway. The regional theater movement is, in short, a big hit. And at 58 years and counting, it's enjoying a very long run. I'm Bob Mondello.
One singular sensation, every little step she takes.
For the next 6 weeks on the program, we'll be visiting theaters from Alaska to Alabama. You can learn more about the series and see photos at our website, npr.org.